case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 87352, Sun Oil Company against Richard Wortman. Mr. Sawatsky, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The questions presented in this case are, first, whether the full faith and credit clause and the due process clause require Kansas, the forum state, to apply the limitations laws of the states of Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana, where the claims arose in favor of class members residing in those states. And secondly, whether Kansas has failed in this case to apply the interest laws of those same states to those claims as required by this Court's decision in Phillips Petroleum Company versus Schutz, which was an identical case to this one, except it did not involve the limitations issue. Sun Oil sells gas from wells located in various states and pays royalty to landowners, thousands of landowners are located in these states. In the 1970s, Sun had filed for and received price increases from the then Federal Power Commission, subject to refund pending a determination of their legality. And once determined to be legal, royalty was paid on the suspended funds representing the increases to the royalty owners, and such payouts were made in July of 1976 and on another occasion in 1978. Plaintiffs filed this suit in August of 1979 in Kansas State Court, seeking to collect interest on the principal payout of these suspended royalties on behalf of a class of these royalty owners located in these various states. 99% of the class members resided in states other than Kansas. Over 90% of the wells were located in Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. Now, in the first Wortman case in 1984, the Kansas courts held that Kansas interest law should be applied to all the claims in all the states, and also held that the Kansas limitation statute, which it determined was 5 years, should apply to all the claims in all the states. Thereafter, this Court decided the Phillips versus Schutz in 1985, which required Kansas to apply the interest laws of the other states to the claims arising in those states. If those laws were different, then it pointed out they probably were different. On Sun's petition, this Court then remanded the first Kansas Wortman case back for reconsideration in light of this Court's case of Phillips versus Schutz. And on reconsideration, the Kansas Court, reviewing many decisions in these other states and not finding anything directly in point, nevertheless held, despite this Court's direction, that the Kansas theory of equitable interest would be uniformly adopted in each one of these states. Then, on the limitations question, when we again raised the constitutional objection that the limitations laws were substantive, certainly as substantive as interest laws, where the difference is between 6% and 10%, between liability and no liability, the Kansas Court adopted what is a standard black-letter conflicts rule, that limitations is remedial or procedural. Therefore, the law of the forum governs.
May I ask you a question? It seemed to me that at least in your brief, you didn't argue that Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma courts consider their shorter statutes of limitations as substantive.
Your Honor, the
Have you cited any authority that would indicate to us that those states regard their statutes of limitations as substantive rather than procedural?
No, Your Honor. Those states follow the common law rule, as Kansas does, as most states do, that the normal statute of limitations, such as we have involved here, are considered procedural or remedial for conflict of laws purposes. That does not mean to say that those states do not apply those laws to the claims arising in each one of those states in such a manner as to terminate completely any claim or cause of action that's arisen in that state. And my whole point, Justice O'Connor, is that the nature of a statute of limitations, when it is applied by each one of these states, is such that constitutionally it is substantive because it deprives a party of a claim.
I can imagine, certainly, that a particular state could make a determination for itself that it wanted to treat a particular statute of limitations as substantive. But absent that, I wonder whether we should assume that it is.
I think that in applying the Constitution, Your Honor, we must look at what a statute of limitations does to a party and to a claim. And because of the history, the common law history by which this common law fiction arose, the fiction that limitations goes to the remedy and not to the right, which arose way back in McLemore versus Cohen. Prior to that time, just a story. I'm getting back into history now, but it goes right to the very essence of this case. And that is that just a story in Leroy versus Crown and Shield analyzed this common law fiction. And from every aspect, he concluded, in effect, that a limitations law by its nature was substantive because it affected the substantive rights of the claimants.
That certainly wasn't the holding of this court in the Wells case, was it?
No, it wasn't. And in the Wells case, Your Honor, there was absolutely no reexamination and no constitutional analysis of limitation statutes or their purposes.
Well, Justice Jackson certainly put forward an argument in his opinion in that case,
yes.
But it didn't carry the day, did it?
It didn't carry the day, Your Honor, because the majority opinion in Wells simply rotely adopted the old McLemore line of cases. And if you look back at McLemore, likewise, it did not analyze the question. One would think that before we rotely adopt an old rule for the sake of old times and antiquity, that we ought to look at the reason behind the rule and see if the rule stacks up in light of the purposes of our Constitution. And if we do go back, you will note that McLemore Wells recited the common law fiction that limitations goes to the remedy and not to the right. Well, that is pretty well accepted by scholars, that remedy, common law remedy type of thing, was basically something to preserve English sovereignty over England's people and its courts. Now, when Justice Story, really the only analysis made in the early days was by Justice Story in the Crown and Shield case, and he examined it by reason and logic and said, in effect, the common law rule is wrong, but it's the law, and I will apply it to the case. But that case didn't involve the Constitution. And if you come to a Constitution where Kansas must respect the laws of Texas, which affect people's rights, like any other substantive law, then we have an issue which is not simply a question of the common law of England. We have a constitutional purpose. Limitations.
Do you think we have to overrule a whole string of cases to hold
well,
you on this?
I don't really think you have to, Your Honor. I think it would be the best thing. I think it would be the best thing that this court could do to overrule them, because it's an old English common law fiction which has been applied without determination.
Don't you have a court of appeals case on your side?
Yes, we do. We have the Perrins case.
The Third Circuit.
The Third Circuit.
What did they say?
They said that constitutionally, under the Full Faith and Credit Clause and the Due Process Clause in particular, the common law rule, should be disregarded because one state should apply the law of another state.
They must have felt that there weren't any cases in this court binding them to hold otherwise.
I think, Your Honor, you're coming to one aspect of my case. Perhaps I bit off a bigger chunk than I should chew by saying that some of these old cases are wrong, which I think they clearly are. But in Keaton versus Hustler Magazine, this court said under a due process analysis, it would reserve the question of whether or not one state must apply the limitations law of another state where the forum state's only connection was the presence of a suit, the bringing of a suit.
Do you think in some of the old cases did that very situation obtain? How could Hustler have reserved that question if there were a lot of cases historically that had addressed that very situation?
Well, yes, that does.
Had they or not?
There had absolutely been no cases discussing and analyzing the Due Process Clause in connection with this problem. The Wells case did not consider it. Certainly McLemore didn't. It was long before the
So it's the constitutional issue that Hustler reserved, you think?
Is perfectly open and right here for this Court in this case. And
how is the due process argument different from the full faith and credit argument?
Well, you look at the due process analysis in the Schutz case itself and in the cases cited by Schutz, and that is that parties are entitled to expect that their activities and their rights and legal obligations will be governed by the laws of the jurisdiction where they undertake their activities and where the alleged wrong or the breach occurs, and that this lends predictability to the law. And this is an element of the fairness incorporated in and an absolute part of the Due Process Clause. Fairness that the parties reasonably expect that this law, where they perform their activities, will be applied.
Predictability is important when you're going to govern your actions by it.
Absolutely.
How do you govern your actions differently if you know that there's a 5-year statute of limitations rather than a 9-year? What, will you make time go faster or make it go slower? There's nothing you can do about a statute of limitations.
The statute of limitations, as this Court has pointed out many times and is generally recognized, is a statute of repose that gives people certainty in their affairs. And if you want to go to a state and conduct your activities where the limitations is 2 or 3 years instead of 5 or 6 years, that's your option.
You think anybody ever conducted affairs in one state versus another because they knew they had a shorter statute? People really advert to statutes of limitations when they conduct their primary conduct? I can't imagine.
Well, I don't think anybody's made a study out of it, Your Honor, but that's one of the elements that goes into your expectancy. Perhaps
part of a favorable climate for business, perhaps.
Well, the point is, though, that in any action there are affirmative defenses of, let's say, unclean hands or something else. Normally we say that because this law affects the rights of the parties, affects this claim in this case, substantively, it wipes it out or it increases it. Therefore, it is subject to the Due Process Clause, and you look to the law of the state and jurisdiction that has an interest in that.
But one can certainly make the argument in the case of the statute of limitations that the primary interest it serves is that of a state, the state's court system, in not trying to process stale claims, which are very difficult to figure out who's right and who's wrong. And that if Texas feels they want a shorter statute of limitations, it's a state interest there that's being vindicated. But if the Kansas court system feels they don't have that same reservation, then why not let Kansas apply its longer statute?
Of course, in our case, you understand, Kansas applied its longer statute, not a shorter statute,
yes,
to bar something. And so this argument technically would not apply. But, and so I wouldn't need to rebut that particular argument. But I think from a standpoint of logic and common sense, this argument which has been made does not bear analysis, because the interest, as far as stale claims is concerned, the parties themselves are interested in it. It's the whether or not there is evidence in this case that has been lost bears upon the parties and on that claim. Now, our courts all the time, every day, handle cases where the evidence is difficult. Whether a statute of limitations has run or not run, or whether any evidence has been lost or not lost, the state where this occurs does not have an interest in the freshness or the staleness of that claim per se because of all these factors. The interest and the impact is upon the parties. Professor Leffler, who has been involved in this situation and studied this for many, many years, succinctly summarizes this in the Mercer Law Review article, which we cite in our reply brief, where the uniform commissioners on state laws studied the problem, and back in the 50s they proposed a uniform rule that the shorter statute would apply, adopting this very argument that the Chief Justice has mentioned. But this turned out to be very unsatisfactory, and his analysis in this article and by the commissioners showed the weaknesses in that, just as I think that I have tried very poorly to mention. And as a result, they concluded that, yes, limitations laws are substantive. And because they are substantive, the law that should be applied in our uniform law proposal is that you look to the law just like any other substantive law of the state where the activity occurred and the claim arose.
And that goes both ways, whether the forum state statute is longer or shorter.
That is correct. That is what they concluded. They disregarded or they discarded what they had formerly proposed. And they studied this, and they know about it. Now, the same thing has occurred in England. It gave rise to this whole problem and has led to all this inconsistency and all this forum shopping, which is caused by the...
May I interrupt just to
yes.
back to Professor Leffler's article. Was he recommending a conflicts of law rule or a constitutional law rule?
His function and his role, Your Honor, was in the conflict of laws area and was proposing that as a uniform rule.
As I have a vague recollection that he is very reluctant to constitutionalize the law of conflicts of laws.
But if you read the article and you read the study and similar scholars and conclude, Your Honor, that this is substantive, that they are correct in saying it's substantive, once you say it's substantive, our Constitution requires us to apply it in that manner. Their role was not to take over the function of this court. Their role was to do what...
What do you do if Texas itself says, when it enacts its statute of limitations, the reason we have these statute of limitations is we don't think our courts can find the facts very accurately or efficiently when the claims are older than this? Now, if other courts want to take a shot at it, if they think they can do better, we don't care. Texas says that. Our statutes of limitations are just procedural. Then you would acknowledge that neither the full faith or credit clause nor the due process clause would require the form to apply them, or would you still say the form had to apply?
I still say, Your Honor, that would apply. Number one, for two reasons. First of all, Texas doesn't really say that. They may say it's procedural, but that's because of this old common law fiction. And secondly, if they did go further and say that because it's procedural, it affects our ability to handle these claims.
It's in the statute.
In the statute. I say it would be unconstitutional because it would not reflect reality. Because the reality is that the administrative upkeep of the courts, the procedure in the courts, is not really affected by whether a statute's longer or shorter. And Professor Leffler points that out very well. And if you assume that what I am saying is correct, and I think it is correct, then a state's artificially saying that something's true that's not true cannot possibly govern the operation of our Constitution. So we come again to the, I was mentioning the law of England. It gave rise to this whole problem. The Law Commission made a study and concluded, yes, limitations laws by their nature are substantive. Therefore, the law in England now is, pursuant to Parliament, that the law of the place where the occurrence happened, where the claim arose, governs, whether longer or shorter, when the action is brought in England. Now, there are also movements underfoot to revise the Restatement of Contracts, Conflicts, Section 142, which recognizing this problem. Because you see, in the Ferens case, the Third Circuit held that this basically was a constitutional problem, we had a situation where an accident in Pennsylvania and barred by the Pennsylvania statute was brought in Mississippi, where they have a longer statute, in federal court. So it's brought in federal court, and the consequence of our old common law rule was that it's procedural, and therefore you apply the law of Mississippi, which was 6 years. Well, then under the forum nonconvenience statute, you bounce it back to federal court in Pennsylvania, where it was barred, of course, if it had been brought there by the statute. And suddenly you have a claim that's alive in Pennsylvania that was really dead in Pennsylvania. And this points out the whole illogic and irrationality of this common law fiction that says that a claim which is dead and unenforceable in the state which created it, and it's gone, nevertheless lives and survives well in any state that fortuitously may have or later enact a longer statute of limitation and allow this kind of forum shopping and hopscotching among the states in litigation to occur. And this is especially a problem in class actions such as this particular case, because what we will have is a forum state that has a law favorable to one particular class or one particular interest. So a class action will migrate to that state, and that state will then, with the longer statute, apply the law everywhere and perhaps apply its own law to the other states like Kansas has here and become a magnet state and a state which applies national law which it creates.
Where I don't follow you, Mr. Sawatsky, is I don't see how we can tell a state that its statute of limitations must be substantive. And once you accept that, then your scheme doesn't give us any more certainty than the existing scheme. We'd still have to examine each state statute of limitations to decide whether they really intend it to be substantive or not. All you're doing is shifting the presumption, I suppose.
If a state were to design a statute of limitations so that it would bear a real relationship to lost evidence and to stale claims, and which could demonstrably improve the administration of cases in its court, that might be one thing. But that is not what we have here. We just have general statutes of limitations, which by their nature are statutes of repose for the benefit of people, because we live in a world of time and space where we draw lines on the map that give jurisdiction, and we draw lines in time which say we go on to something new. And people are entitled to rely on that. And it's important in civilization ever since the early 17th century under the King James statutes, which originated most of these statutes of limitations. And the way they operate is to operate substantively. The scholars generally...
How do you get different statutes of limitations in the same state? Depending on whether it's personal injury, trespass to real property, personal property, that sort of thing.
This, again, is a combination of objects by the state. For example, libel and slander might be 1 year in most states, but 2 years or longer in some other states, even though the evidence of libel may be maintained for years and years. But there is something about the public policy entitling people to repose and saying to people that have claims and know about them, you assert these in a certain time or they are lost, and the defendant, the other party, is entitled to be free and go about his business and not worry about it. And there are different times for different types of activities, different wrongs, different breaches of contract. So, again, these are for the substantive repose of the litigants and to allow life to go on. And they are substantive because they affect the particular claim. They terminate it entirely when it's applicable. Now, under the present rule, the procedural rule, we can bring a case in Nevada, for example, against the Howard Hughes estate, be barred by limitations by the claim arising there, but the plaintiff then may march over to Texas and bring an action and say, you have a longer statute, and I'm not barred by the judgment there. You not only do not give full faith and credit to the limitations law, but you don't give full faith and credit to the judgment because it didn't bar it on the merits. It was just procedural. And then if Texas, for some reason, should find it barred, you jump over to another state. Now, that's an actual case cited from Texas, cited by the respondents. And there's this business of substance and procedure is just an awful mess. Now, I'm not proposing that this court need to get involved in delineating when a state, for its own purposes, may call something procedural or substantive. Statutes of limitation by their nature are substantive. And constitutionally, under due process, under the Ferens case, under the expectations of the parties, under the due process clause, they're entitled to rely upon the law of the state, that bundle of substantive rights which was created in that state where that claim arose. Now, Schreiber case, I mentioned the Ferens case, and I was really thinking of the Schreiber case in the Tenth Circuit before, where the Schreiber case allowed the action to be perpetuated in Kansas when it was barred in Kansas by being filed in Mississippi. In the Ferens case, they said, you can't do that. You can't jump over to Mississippi and come back to Pennsylvania and let the case continue because the Constitution requires that you look to the law where the claim arose and prevent this kind of nonsense, jumping back and forth between the states and applying hit or miss fortuitously somebody's jurisdiction's longer statute of limitations. Now, I have mentioned the lack of finality. It's an object of the full faith and credit clause, of course, in particular, to obtain finality in litigation, as this court has held, Justice White in particular. Another thing that's happened as a result of this old McLemore rule is that borrowing statutes were created by the states because there was a constitutional void. It doesn't seem right, this whole mess. Did not seem right to many states, and they enacted borrowing statutes to apply the statutes of limitations of these other states.
Is there an interest argument here? What rate of interest?
Yes, there is.
You're going to leave that to your brief? Or?
I'm going to argue that right now, Your Honor.
That's a good idea.
Because the Kansas court on remand, after being directed by this court to look to the laws of these other states, I will mention Texas as the prime example. In Texas, the Stahl case held in exactly this kind of a case that the Texas statutory 6% rate applied. The Stahl case cited the Schutz case in Kansas as a case awarding interest. The Stahl case mentioned the higher federal rate of interest in the federal statute, but it did not adopt the higher rate that Kansas had proposed in its Schutz case, which the Texas court cited. It did not adopt the higher federal rate that from the federal statute, which Kansas had adopted. And no case since then has done so. There is no law in Texas that says in this case or in this kind of a case, a rate higher than 6% applies. And yet Kansas, under the guise of predicting that the Texas courts would adopt the Kansas theory, if presented to it, said we'll apply the same law in Texas because we think that's what they would find.
And the rate?
The rate that Kansas found was the federal rate, a rate that ranged up to 18 to 20%.
And they thought that Texas courts would apply that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They did.
Thank you, Mr. Sawatsky. I will hear now from you, Mr. Penny.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I believe the Court granted certiorari in this case to consider these interesting and important choice of law questions, and they're difficult and subtle, and they shouldn't be regarded lightly. But I think it's important not to become so deeply involved in the intricacies of choice of law that we lose sight of the fundamental question in this case. And in my opinion, the fundamental question is, are our courts, our institutions of justice, capable of redressing an enormous interstate ripoff by a large national corporation at the expense of about 3,000 people located in several states? Or does the expense of individual suits and the fact that the victims are located in many of the states mean that the courts can do little for them and that the defendant can take and use their money with no real fear of accounting? The facts in this case show that Sun used money belonging to the plaintiff class members for several years and paid no compensation for its use. This is money, is not money that Sun thought they might own. It was money which Sun never could own. It either belonged to the royalty owners, our clients, or it had to be refunded back to pipelines.
Well, Mr. Penny, with all respect, I didn't think that was why we took the case. We concede what the merits are. I thought we were here to decide whether the Kansas court should what statute of limitations should be applied and what interest rate should be applied to those claims arising in other states.
I believe you're right, Justice O'Connor. I'll get on
with that. So do you plan to talk about those?
Yes, I do.
While I have you interrupted, what if Texas, for example, passed a law that made it crystal clear it considered its shorter statute of limitations to be substantive? Do you think the full faith and credit clause might require Kansas to apply that Texas law?
Yes, I do, Justice O'Connor. If Kansas did not have enough other contacts with the litigation to make its application of its own statute of limitations reasonable, I think I'd like to talk a little bit now about substantive and procedural. I'm not sure that the labels are very important here, but they're more than labels. And this is evident by the fact that when a case is dismissed because it's brought too late for the statute of limitations, when it's an outlawed claim, that's not treated anywhere that I'm aware of as a judgment on the merits. Statutes of limitations have been considered procedural rather than substantive because they have nothing to do with the substance of the lawsuit, nothing to do with whether it's just or unjust. They're just either too old or still fresh enough to try. Substantive laws, judge governing liability, have entirely to do with whether a claim is just or unjust. I guess statutes of limitation are, in that, in their application, are completely arbitrary. They draw a line. In this case, Sun says we are approximately 2 months too late on a part of the claims in this case. They don't allege that they're damaged in any way by our 2 month delay. The records have not gone anywhere. Witnesses haven't died. Their computers haven't burned up. There's no damage, but that's the way statutes of limitations work. The attack on Kansas' application of its own statutes of limitation is made on a couple of different grounds, and I'd like to talk about the 14th Amendment ground first. As I read the cases of this court, the 14th Amendment would not require Kansas to apply the statute of limitations of another state. In Haig versus Allstate and Phillips versus Schutz, this court determined what modest restrictions there are on a state's application of its own substantive law. It seems to me that in application of a law which is part of the state's policy, part of the state's machinery for regulating its judicial process, that the restrictions on the state's action should be even more modest. Due process of law, as Mr. Sawatsky discussed, has a great deal to do with the expectation of the parties. And for the last 150 years, I suppose any reasonably well-informed potential litigant in this country would expect that the statute of limitations of the forum would apply in any lawsuit brought against that person.
Of course, by that standard, you would never be able to overrule any case that says something or that says old processes, due processes, in effect, because people are used to living under that regimen.
Well,
perhaps that's not a disadvantage.
It's not a disadvantage as far as I'm concerned. It is a somewhat of a circular argument, and I acknowledge that. It seems like there are a lot of them in this area.
And others.
Oh, you say and others?
And others.
Oh, I see. It simply doesn't seem to me that Kansas is required by the Constitution to surrender control over its own courts to other states. And that's what we would have if Kansas is required to apply statutes of limitations of other states. Kansas has interests in this case, which make application of its statutes of limitations and other procedural rules reasonable rather than unreasonable. I think in the administration of its court system, there's a whole package of procedural rules. I think Kansas has an interest in maintaining the integrity of this package and of the scheme which it has, as a sovereign state, has in regulating litigation in its own courts. It has an interest in regulating Sun Oil Company, which is qualified to do business and does do business in Kansas. I think there is an interest here in cooperating with other states to furnish a forum where this, where these 3,000 approximately claims can be litigated in one action. That would save judicial resources, simplify the task. And, of course, Kansas has an interest in regulating the oil and the gas business, which is an important commercial activity in Kansas. The other prong of the attack is full faith and credit. And as I understand this attack on Kansas, on the application of the forum statute of limitations, is that it somehow impairs other states' interests or offends other states in the Union. It's difficult for me to see how this can be when the other states involved here consider their statutes of limitations to be procedural. They affect only the remedy. None of the other states canceled Sun's debt. Louisiana, perhaps, where we concede the statute of limitations had expired on the part of the claims, Louisiana didn't cancel Sun's debt. Louisiana simply says, we consider this a claim for rent. We have historically applied a 3-year statute of limitations. You're more than 3 years. Sometimes this state's interest in sometimes it's hard to tell what a state's policy might be from the statute or what the intention was. But when Oklahoma, one of the states involved here, adopted the Uniform Statute of Limitations on foreign claims, I believe that was in the 50s, this was a uniform act that was not universally popular. Only 3 states, including Oklahoma, ever adopted it. And its general scheme was to make the shorter statute of limitations apply to bar the claim. However, when Oklahoma adopted this uniform law, they took out one word and inserted another to make it mean that when the statute of limitation shall be either that prescribed by the law of the place where the claim accrued or by the law of this state, whichever last bars the claim. Oklahoma was there expressing, in that context, their policy and decision that whichever last bars the claim should prevail. This excuse me, sir. Well, apparently so. As this court has said, the statute of limitations represents a policy about the privilege to litigate. The shelter of the statute of limitations in such a way as to benefit a potential defendant is simply a byproduct or a fallout of that. I think this is recognized intuitively, and it has been recognized specifically by this court. We have a question in petitioner's brief, this being nonsense, to have a right without a remedy. This has been with us a long time, and I think the courts have always recognized this. Rights without remedies are of some good. They can be offset. They do furnish consideration for a new promise to pay. There may be a change of state policy, in which case your remedy comes alive again, as in the Chase Securities case cited in our briefs. These cases, we do not believe, are barred by either Texas or Oklahoma law, if those states' laws were to apply. We cite in our brief the longer statutes of limitations of those states, that is, the statutes dealing with recovery on written contracts. These are on written contracts, the oil and gas leases. Although our recovery was probably based more on the theory of unjust enrichment, it was unjust enrichment by Sun keeping the money it owed our clients under the written contracts for longer than it should have. Maybe one of the thorniest problems in this case is the Kansas court's determination of the other state's law. When the companion case, Phillips, was here before, the majority opinion questioned the Kansas court's finding all the law the same. Kansas has looked at these substantive laws of the other states again and has come to the same conclusion. Typically, historically, a decision of this type by a state court has been entitled to great respect from this court. And there are, I think, good reasons for that. Sometimes it's very difficult for a state court to decide what a neighboring state court might do if faced with a particular fact situation. Maybe there's no clear-cut answer. It has to be decided, though. And the question is, once it's decided, does another court then second-guess or look again? The law...
Well, you had here a Texas case that had used the lower interest figure.
Yes, sir.
And in the face of that, the Kansas court said, no, the next time around they're going to use a higher one.
Yes. The Stahl case was, which did apply 6% interest, was an unusual case. That was all that Stahl ever asked for in that case. It was a declaratory judgment action brought by Phillips, the oil company, which had paid Stahl certain principal amounts. Phillips requested judgment that it was not liable for any interest on the amounts already paid out, and in addition also asked for that money back. Stahl counterclaimed for 6% interest, and it was allowed by the court. There's no suggestion that he ever asked for any more. In addition to the Stahl case, there have been in Texas a great ferment of cases involving prejudgment interest since the Stahl case was decided. They're cited in our brief, but Kavnar versus Quality Control Parking is one of the cases in which the Texas Supreme Court said, from now on, in cases of this type, we are going to have prejudgment interest, and it will be at the same rate as the legislative, as the statute on post-judgment interest presently is.
Those are personal injury cases.
Yes, sir, personal injury. And then later there's there are several more Texas Court of Appeals cases, some going both ways. February 10th, the Texas court decided a case called Perry Roofing Company versus Olcott, which is in a supplemental brief which I believe was filed yesterday, in which the Texas Supreme Court cleared the question up and said, we will, unless you can, well, let me back up a little bit. Their ruling was, if you have a case on a contract, and by looking at the face of the contract, you can tell how much money is due on the contract, then their 6% interest rate applies. They have judicially limited the application of that 6% statute. On all other cases, as I understand the Texas ruling, they are granting prejudgment interest at the a rate corresponding to the bank prime rate, compounded daily. This is strictly by the action of the Texas Supreme Court, and the Kavanaugh case, I believe, was 1985. All those cases are in our brief. I think if the Kansas court missed the application, missed the mark on the Texas law, it didn't miss it by very far. The Federal Power Commission rate, which the Kansas court found applicable, is also based on the bank prime rate. And it's a floating rate, though, rather than being set at the date of judgment, as is the Texas rule under Kavanaugh. In Louisiana, there has been new legislation which would indicate the Kansas court was not far off the mark there either. I would say that, the prediction missed by some amount. Louisiana Civil Code, Article 2000, this is not cited in our brief, but is in the latest Kansas case of Phillips versus Schutz, Schutz versus Phillips. Louisiana Civil Code, Article 2000, a statute on prejudgment interest, which is declared to be retrospective and prospective, adopted effective January 1 of 1985, calls for 12% interest on money due in Louisiana if there is no other contract. Maybe if the Kansas court missed the prediction by a ways on the Louisiana substantive rate of interest, it did the same as the federal courts did in Boot versus Chevron, which were federal cases involving exactly the same type of money, came up in Louisiana, and the federal courts there said, this was at a time when Chevron still held the money and hadn't paid it out. In fact, the rate increases were not yet final. The landowners were trying to collect the money before the rate increases were final.
So the Kansas court was a little bit wrong. Should we say, well, it's only a little bit, so we affirm? Or do they have to do it over again?
Well, Your Honor, I think the probably the way to finality of judgments is to affirm if a good faith effort was made by the court to arrive at what the other state's court law is.
Or would be.
Right.
At the time of this judgment, was the Louisiana law the way you say it is now?
Yes, it was. This 12% statute had been adopted.
Just didn't look at the Louisiana code then.
No. I'll agree with that. It's not the code.
How about Texas?
Texas law, the Kavanaugh case, I believe, came down in 1985.
Came later.
Yes. And the
Oklahoma?
The Texas Supreme Court judgment applying it to all types of cases, or really confirming that it applies to all types of cases, just came last month.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Supreme Court of Kansas opinion is June 8, 1987. That should be after the Texas case you referred to, the Kavanaugh case, shouldn't it?
Yes, it was after the Kavanaugh case.
I see. How about Oklahoma?
Okay, Oklahoma has, I am honestly embarrassed that this statute is not cited in our brief. Oklahoma has a statute. It's not 6%, but it's 12%. It's a statute specifically dealing with late payments of oil and gas royalties, and it has been around since 1980. It's Title 52, Section 540.
And the Kansas court just borrowed the federal rule, the federal rate?
The Kansas court applied the federal rule to
all. Saying that these other states would do the same thing?
Yes. I believe
they would not do that. I mean, is it clear from the Texas case law that given a case that specifically involved this kind of a situation, they wouldn't use the federal agency's rule rather than?
No, I don't think it's that clear, Justice Scalia. In this case,
you think there's some possibility that they got it entirely right?
Yes. I think it was a good faith effort, and I think if one of these cases comes before one of the other courts, Texas, Oklahoma, or Louisiana, I think it's quite likely they would do exactly as the Kansas court did.
In spite of a statute?
Yes.
In Oklahoma, it says that here's the interest rate on overdue royalties, but we nevertheless will apply the federal rate.
I think that would make it more difficult. However, Kansas had a general interest rate statute as well, which the Kansas court decided not.
Have you got a citation for the Oklahoma statute that you didn't have in your brief?
It's Title 52, Section 540.
May I ask if that statute was called to the attention of the Kansas Supreme Court by either party to the litigation?
It was not, Your Honor. And maybe this is incompetence on our part.
You at least had a theory that the federal rule applied.
Yes.
They opposed it. What did they claim?
They claimed 6%. Oklahoma has a general statute or a general interest statute of 6%.
But isn't there an issue in here not only post-judgment but pre-judgment interest?
Yes, sir. I've been talking all throughout about pre-judgment interest.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And the only place
I thought there was some argument that these other states wouldn't give prejudgment interest at all.
Yes, there was that claim made.
Well,
it would be especially with respect to Oklahoma. The claim was made that there would be no prejudgment interest.
That was a common law rule, wasn't it?
Yes. I think that would be very difficult to maintain inside of the particular statute they have on there. And again,
may I ask about the Oklahoma statute? I understand neither party cited it, and I understand your theory was a federal rule applied. Were you aware of the statute at the time the case was argued in Kansas?
I was not aware of the statute until yesterday.
I see. And you don't know whether your opponent was or not?
No. It was never cited to any court considering.
Well, what about the Louisiana statute?
The Louisiana statute was cited by the Kansas court in the Schutz versus Phillips case.
Well, how about in this case?
The Kansas court's opinion in this case referred to the Schutz case, which had been decided a month earlier.
Well, how come then they said the Louisiana would apply the federal rule?
There was a case in Louisiana called Boot versus Chevron, in which the federal court said, whenever this money is paid out, it was dicta in the case, but the federal court did say, Chevron, you don't have to pay the money out until the rates become final. But when you do pay the money out, you will pay them to the royalty owners together with the same rate of interest as you're required to by your Federal Power Commission undertaking. There was also a federal court case in Texas, Sid Richardson Oil and Gas Company, in which the federal judge said the same thing. That naturally, when the money goes out, it will go out at, with the same rate of interest. Here, I think the court has two options on this determination of other states' law. One would be to affirm the Kansas decision, which is made in good faith. Whether it's exactly like state law turns out to be 2 or 3 years later or a year or two later probably doesn't happen very often, even when a federal court predicts what a state court is going to decide, or a federal court predicts what a neighboring state court will decide. The other option, I think, would be to find that the Kansas determination was erroneous, although I submit by a very small amount, and enter judgment for interest in accord with the Oklahoma statute, the Texas Kavanaugh rule on prejudgment interest, and the Louisiana Civil Code section. If there are no other questions, I'll finish.
Thank you, Mr. Penny. The case is submitted.